one isn't really, this one isn't politically correct. And I apologize in advance to any vegetarian folks. I don't think vegetarians make good poets. The lack of meat must mean less poem protein. Unless the poet sees lots of pulses, which everyone knows produces only 40 poems with no muscle or substance. No bristle to chew on, no full flesh, no backbone. It's something Byron understood. You can't write poetry if you don't eat blood.
Okay.
I'm going to try and do a Billy Ramsell on this and remember a poem. It's called Photograph. Photograph. The American students pose on the steps of the National Museum. Three rows of shiny hair and perfect teeth. She kneels in the middle of the bottom tier. Fresh face, well groomed. Say cheese, yells the teacher, taking the shot. And suddenly I see another girl, not born yet, not even conceived. She takes the silver frame photograph from the mantelpiece, points to her mother and says, that was in Dublin on her senior school tour. Can you believe she was ever that young?
You're not talking about anyone we know there, are you?
Actually, someone I saw taking a photograph in front of the National Museum.
Okay, next up we have Mr. Joe Sweeney.
Thanks, Paul. Hope you're ready now for a little moment of terror. It's 1847. It's a little cottage in the Valley of Tresna. The famine has decimated the valley. No one is left in the valley but three little children in a little cottage. The dogs, the strays are starving. They've gathered round the cottage and are into the cottage now. The children have retreated into a little back room, which was their grandmother's bedroom where she died some days before. The dogs cram into the room, surging towards the children, baying, snarling. The children's lips are moving, their teeth chattering, not in prayer anymore, but in terror. The power to pray has left them. They can think of nothing now, believe in nothing. Their minds blank, their bodies weak with fear, their eyes stare into the utter blackness in the room. Staring right back at them is death, suddenly. There is a screeching sound. It takes Ellie a moment, a long, slow moment, to register what it is. She looks around. It is Deirdre shrieking at the top of her voice. One of the dogs has sunk its teeth into one of her legs. She's striking at it with her fists, but to no avail. The dog doesn't even flinch at her blows. Its tough, wiry body is hard as stone. Ellie begins screeching too as the dogs come at her. Tiger shouting and trying to kick them away. Things are now totally out of the children's control. Deirdre faints, her little body slides down on the floor. Tiger and Ellie kicking and punching at the dog somehow manage to stoop down and haul Deirdre off between them. The dogs snarl and dart in, trying to bite. And then, the strangest moment. Moonlight streams into the bedroom like waves, filling the room, washing away the darkness. Through the broken pane, a perfectly round moon appears. The white bones on the floor glow as if lit from within. And then, from the other corner of the bedroom, where their grandmother's old rocking chair is, there comes a series of sounds, faint but terrible. The sound of the rocking chair creaking. The sound of a long, drawn-out, agonized sigh. The sound of the floorboards creaking. Something lurches forward, and the sound of rapping. The dogs stop moving, stop barking, and twist their heads around, looking at the chair, rocking back and forth in the corner. The atmosphere of the room is still, heavy, unbearable, as if a crushing boulder is about to bear down on it. Something presses the children even tighter against the wall, and the dogs remain immobile with fear. Children cling onto each other's hands. Something sails into the room, as if traveling on the moonlight. An extraordinary silence. It is an unearthly moment. And when it passes, it leaves in its wake a tingling in the air like little bells ringing, feeling like pins and needles in the children's bodies. The dogs are unable to approach the children as if there is an invisible cage around them. Their eyes water and expand with terror. They look around, twisting their bodies, aware of something menacing them, but unable to understand what it is. It is no smell, no feel, no substance, yet it is so powerful they cannot move with it. It holds the room in a giant fist. It could crush the life out of everything, every living creature in the room, and snatch them away with it, right over into the eternal abyss of death. Pure power. This is not real, Ellie tries desperately to think, but her mind is swirling around like a leaf in a storm beyond her grasp. This cannot be happening. The dogs crouch down, whimpering, aware of the presence even more than the children, pressing low to the floor, as if they want the earth to swallow them up.
Series for quite some time, yeah. And next, I'd like to call up our reigning Five Water champion, who's come all the way from Australia to sing us a few poems, Helen Lindstrom.
Thanks, Paul. I'd like to read three from my first collection, which is called Cold Comfort. The first two are about growing up. The tent. She was a camper by day. In cheap thongs. Oh, hang on. I better say what thongs is in Australian. It's what you wear on your feet. What the Americans call flip flops. We call them thongs. This we call the other type of song a G-string.
Okay.
And don't ask me what Bach played on. Okay. Oh, no, I've got that. Sorry. Air on a G-string, yeah. Okay, the tent. She was a camper by day. In cheap thongs, her feet took her through dry grass, sharp as skewers, up sheer black rocks, following her father, his back a carapace of black flies as he wandered the island on his quest for the best fishing spot. At night, as the voices of the adults ebbed into silence, she slid away to lie beside a boy, familiar by day, but in the dark tent, strange, the feel of his skin like touching light. And the next one is called Bloodshed. I woke one morning and saw blood. Overnight, something in me that was previously concealed, some potion, some sly spell, had grubbed its way along my blood furrows. Through me and with me and in me it ran, and I was glad, for it spelled the end of my childhood. Then I joined the band of proud, disparaging girls who every month made burned offerings of their blood in the school incinerator. Huddled in the shelter shed like a coven, we spelled out the litany, the names of those who had it, the names of those who didn't have it, while those who didn't have it kept to their games, and the nuns patrolled the outskirts of the playground, and the charred smell of our offerings hung over us all like a curse. And this is one that isn't in this collection, called Cinderella. That day I lost my left slipper again. It was always coming off, sinister. Charming fault, of course. Ever since that night when he'd found that first glass slipper, he'd developed a foot fetish, insisted on buying all my shoes, always glass, always in odd sizes. Size 5 for the right foot, that was okay, but size 10 for the left. Even bigger than my stepsister's clodhoppers. I had to hobble round the castle, hard to sway and glide in odd glass slippers. I was slipshod. One false move and my feet were tatters. I heard the servants cackle when I tripped. Forget barefoot and pregnant. I've been barefoot. I could stride. I could run fast. As for pregnant, well, let's just say the bloke has to do a bit more than play footsies every night. Dipstick. Anyway, that day, as usual, I was alone, his trophy wife, on the throne, thinking. And as usual, I had no idea where he was. Couldn't take me anywhere, he said. Used to like his bit of rough, but now he called me rude, slapdash. I munched, I hunched, he said I snivelled. Once he caught me wiping my nose on my ermine. Well, suddenly I couldn't stand it any longer. That day I kicked off my right slipper, watched it smash on the tiled floor, heard it splinter the marbled silence. Then I walked away, head high, shoulders back, regal. He would have marveled. Still, I couldn't face the servants. I left by a side door, climbed the wall, cut both my feet, blood on the soil, a freedom trail. In the distance, a pumpkin yellow coach and 6 black horses roaring towards me. And my last one just might give you a taste of what Australia's like in January, our summer. Thank you. January 1. Oh, and I should explain in this poem, in the last verse, it talks about corellas. They're a type of white cockatoo. In summer, they flock down to where we live. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, so you can't see the sky really for birds, and they're all shrieking. And I use the word haka, which you probably know from rugby, don't you, that the New Zealanders do? Yeah. January 1. Early morning. I want to take that silver cobweb the sun has just highlighted and tether this moment, the quiet light, the soft air. 2. At midday, the hot, dry smell of my garden is like an ironing board, a pigeon sunning itself, pointing one wing at the sky like a feathered sundial casts no shadow. 3. Towards evening, dust rides in on a hot wind, flirts with the dry leaves, needles the windows, sprawls across the veranda. Although from inside the house it may sound like rain, dust is the opposite of rain. 4. All day the sky has hugged the clouds to itself in clenched fists. Above the third tongue of the riverbed, corellas wheel, screeching their haka of the all-whites. The clouds retreat. The sky keeps a poker face. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen. Next, could we go up to Sue Cosgrove?
Thank you, Ben. This poem is called Dream. And it's not a dream within a dream, it's not a dream. So, just dream. I hear the call, unhusk my tongue, this cloth satin ribbon that leads me along a kaleidoscopic byway, where every narrow tree is ringed in garlands of night black feathers, recalling to me your feathered boar, your spray stiffened beehive, your hands sheathed in pearls that glint as you stand in the blinking hallway light at the mouth of my room, where sour nuggets droop to your feet. These apples of Sodom, newborn babes I endow with names, craven soul Apollyon, festering tongue Beelzebub, changing avatar, forever lost, nay say yes, dank, daughter you deprive of warmth, the forgotten oblivion, the bautiless neep, maenad, depraved and mad,
fallen like a bliss, the empty mix, and then, last of all, taboo, the way whose love is always forbidden. How I wish I could drown them within undreamed rivers, but they burst in my hand in acrid puffs of ash. Thank you.
Next up, could we call Eugene O'Carroll?
I want to do two poems with an oriental theme. On the pier, the yellow of a lake in autumn washes my eyes, clarifies. A breeze blows open the pages of the album you gave me. Time passes, so I'm not sure if it was your hair, eyes, or mouth that had the peculiar color of smoke. Sorrow is a mood, the lake lifts, the geese with undercarriage down coming into land, the sound of a flute carrying over the water. The other poem is I was in Shanghai, and I have to say that I was very moved by it, the experience of it. And I wrote this poem just to show the point. So everybody was saying you have to write a poem before you leave Shanghai because they were nervous. The other thing about Shanghai is that the skyscrapers, you just have to see, it's actually like a porcupine who's in a ball, and every one of his quills is a skyscraper. The poem is called Bloom Note, because I haven't written one page. You must write a poem before you leave Shanghai. The others did, you must. Skyscrapers at my window, I can't see the sky. You must write a poem before you leave Shanghai. The gleaming towers, the bund, skyscrapers at my window, I can't see the sky. You must write a poem before you leave Shanghai. The others did. Must. Skyscrapers at my window. I can't see the sky.
Thank you, Eugene. And next we call Marie Perry.
Last wolf of the acorn wood line. I was scratching my hide on a pine when the three little pigs scampered by, carrying their purses on sticks. All talk of fortunes just round the corner. On the bright village green they ran naked, skin pink as the insides of cheeks, tails coiled like eggs, catching treats, pirouetting on little split feet. Piggy one blagged a bundle of straw from old Ryan. Then did weaver-bred pricks with their stalk from some twine, 2 shillings short of a pound, but he tastes divine. Picky two, old brawn and no brain, tottered under a bundle of sticks, Herculean. His back was cross-hatched and mixed, ready-made crackling, the lips snapping bit. 3 bore, over and over, he groans about bricks being the thing to keep wolf from the door. Einstein he is. But I'll dine tonight on Zeredite Hyde, last pig of the acorn wood line. Keeper of the bees. My father captured wild bees, teeming brown beards that hung from tree branches. He carried them back to hives hidden in rough grass, clotted with clover, where they foraged and buzzed a discordant orchestra, while the gander guarding his harem paraded and hissed. Hapless beside him, my brother, lifting square bullions up to the sun, head haled with bees, the chosen one.
Thank you, Marie. And next on the list, I have Raymond Desmond.
I wrote this after a chat with my five-year-old nephew called Little Child. Little child, little child, you know what is wrong and what is right. Why don't I? You know how to be happy when you are happy, how to be sad when you are sad. When will I? No analyzing, no theory, just feeling. You know, you see what's truly there. You live your life with fun and with laughter. When will I? When will I? Asking questions of those who should be asked, forgotten questions with no answers. Who made the rules? Why are there rules? What if there were no rules? Why is it this way? Does it have to be? You are right, of course, you always were. As was I, as was she, as was he. We had just forgotten. But it's never too late to be a little child, to laugh, to play, to sing and dance, and to feel with all your heart.
Thanks very much. And next up, Mr. Seamus Harrison.
The wash. It bobs and turns turtle without a single bubble, dancing past my transom, a fairy liquid bottle. You know when you put in the nozzle of a petrol or diesel hose, pull the trigger, and the power doesn't get on? This is what caused this bore. Reach. I swing clear of the saddle. He's left-handed. We draw together, squeeze the triggers, nothing. My eye is caught by the cactus, sulking behind the window pane. We crouch a yard apart, but he never sees my face. His calf-skinned knuckles shake at the sudden surge of power. I feel the nozzle kick to my bike's unleaded stream. The diesel digits spin by his silver bullet van. We pump a yard apart, but I never see his face. This came in the post this morning, an anthology called Extinction from Basculier Publishing. And this is an old one, but I still like it. The Stalker. I stalk the alley to and fro each day. My evil eye betrays a clear intent. My spring is high enough to reach my prey. These legal clamps are known as my cachets. My primal needs do not entail consent. I stalk the alley to and fro each day. At every chance I strike without delay. And when I do, they'll not require a stent. My spring is high enough to breach my prey. This broken thrush was doing a slow sachet. Unlike the other 99%, I walk the alley to and fro each day. I yet to taste the hooded crow's dismay. He scans the lane before each rare descent. My spring's not high enough to leech that prey. Oh yes, I draw a blank some weeks, but hey, I never show a sign of discontent, but stalk the alley to and fro each day. My spring is high enough to bleach my prey.
Thank you, Seamus. Next we have Colin Scully.
This is just a short one I wrote recently. I'll just explain one more because I had to look it up myself. Mamluks. Mamluks were the ruling class in Egypt in the Middle Ages. And I think they were the ruling classes in throughout a lot of the Arab world at the same time. but I suppose the thing about Mamluks was that they were descended from slave soldiers who were brought in by the king to support, and they ended up taking over the kingdom. So when you heard Mamluks, it kind of refers to slaves. It's called the Minarets at Little Island. I see the minarets translucent in the sun, three tall conspiring towers perpetually strong. There are gated rails and caps, their mild steel dull and sheen, exhausting fumes and gases, corrosive clouds of steam. Their sky is an Irish sky, a factory floor, their town, no burnished baked stone streets, enameled Persian domes, but still sight of oaks, a spiritual trance, as Mamluks tread below, pursuing sustenance.
That's gone. What's that? Is it last call?
Yeah.
Okay. So, anyone who'd like a drink? Now's your chance. Next up to the mic, Ross O'Donovan.
Times were good, I wasn't ready. Times were bad, I wasn't ready. Times were great, I'm too late. Times were worse, I call it a curse. If things happen for a reason, why does my life feel like treason? I can't hang on to this bullshit. It's eating me up, let's throw another fit. What? Where? When? How? Talking is the best therapy. Thinking no one listening is the worst. Placebo, placebo, placebo. This is a bit of a satirical note. I wrote this morning. I had these ideas in my head and thought they were extremely funny, so I had to get them on paper really fast. So the title is "Oh Bitch Too Airy." What is wrong with my bloody clock? Alters digital times. Dates on newspapers designed to mock. Seasons change with crimson signs. What do you expect from me? To be able to deal with such tragedies? Imagine dreaming you cannot sleep, and all you sold was not reaped. A sacrifice is made with regret. Addiction stopped for now, I'll bet. Do not grow up too fast, for you were old before your time. Look to my heart and find that youth was once was mine. Your image is burned upon my retinas, and you got on my optic nerves. So what do you call a person who is blind and yet has vision? I know, an oxymoron.
Yeah.
I have a silly condition. It's called an anal itch. So scratch me whole and draw the door because society deems it fit.
Thanks, Ross. I've got two names left on the open mic, so if there's anyone else out there who hasn't got a phone who would like to. Anyone? No? And I have Alan firmly on the list. just to proceed him, is Mr. Connor McManus.
Thanks, Bob. This is part of a larger piece. Now the Benmen were gone and High Street was still in the shade. I wished I could kick football in the shaded empty street, or be on Dolan's flat roof with the captain and Tom Finn and his room with the brass tips, but I was laden with books and heading off to school. Heavy bag, empty head, somebody said. Dan Donahue with his cart was making his way down High Street. Dan's cart was made up of a metal frame on two bicycle wheels that carried two metal dustbins. There were hooks on either side where he rested his wide shovel and black bristled yard brush. As I approached, he left the brush back on the hooks of the cart and he called me aside into the gateway beside the house. I didn't know what he wanted, and I was already late for school. I knew Dan from being up and down the High Street every morning, and I knew he had a brother who was a cobbler with a short leg, and learned cobbling by having to make his own boots, one with the high sole and heel to compensate for the short leg, and now he was fixing shoes for other people. He always wore a light grey suit and tie and hat and dark rimmed glasses, even of a fair day. And even of a fair day, the black boots would be polished and shone to the last, and you wouldn't notice a thing. That must have been the thing about cobblers. They learn by making their own shoes. That reminded me I had to go down to Tom Welch to get a pair of shoes. Anyway, I didn't know what Dan Donahue wanted, but I followed him into the gateway. And Dan took his fat cap off and placed it on the ground to kneel on, and got down on one knee beside me, and took my hand in his big farmer's road sweeper's hand, and looked at the finger with the wart up beside the nail. The wart was still white from the Compound W I put on it. Compound W was like acid. It was going to burn it off slowly. The Compound W came in a small bottle, and I was on the second one, but it was having no effect. I tried dipping it in the holy water font in the church porch every Sunday, but that didn't work. And there was a rock in the fair green with a hole in it, and water in the hole, and I stuck my finger into that, and that was supposed to do the job. But I was still waiting for the wart to fall off. Without saying a word, Dan rummaged in his long coat pocket and produced two handkerchiefs, which he laid on the ground. And with his own wrist resting on his high knee, he opened back the folds of the first one, all the while holding my hand. On the handkerchief were five fresh green rushes laid out like spears, smooth and shiny, perfect, the very tips just beginning to go brown. He lifted the rushes one at a time, and holding them at one end, he proceeded to pull them across the wart like a fiddler's bow. He mumbled a prayer to himself while scratching the sign of the cross, with a loose thumb on his forehead, lips and chest, and then replaced the rush gently back on the white linen. He repeated the same drill with each rush. When that was complete, he opened the second handkerchief to display five cigarette butts, which he lined up in a row, and proceeded to rub the sucked end on the wart in the sign of the cross. He did this more rapidly than with the rushes, and with quicker, shorter mumbles, and when all was done, he scratched again with his loose thumb, his forehead, lips and chest, and paused for a moment, head bowed, before letting go my hand without saying a word. Then he rolled up his two handkerchiefs, stood up, slapped his cap off his tie before placing it on his head, and went back to sweep in the street. I knew a lot about cures, but I didn't know Dan Donahue had the cure for warts, and I didn't know how Dan Donahue knew I had a wart, and I never heard of the rushes and cigarette butts once, and I wondered if he had the cure for warts in the stomach. I couldn't wait to get to school to tell Malloy about the warts and the cigarette butts.
Thank you, Connor. And the only person who's possibly going to follow that this evening is Mr. Alan Tiffy.
Not that way. I was sitting there wondering what word rhymes with Mamelux, you know. I thought of it, but I'm not going to repeat it. This is a translation of an 18th century Irish poem. Before I came out, I was looking at a program on the greatest Irish people who ever lived, and it was on Mary Robinson. And it was Mary Robinson made the song Manon Héireann famous. And this is a translation, but if you bear with me, can I sing it first? And then I try to translate it as well. Todan in Erin, Avrong of Sheldon is small and old. Todan in Erin, Snirvish the Lim are awfully cold. Nosh in him till Todan in Erin. Sneer of our lady, oh, Michelle Lemrick, Mahar Begre, Smahar Fjord. So then in a ring, a gosh in a dum, Maravain a hog, O then a real hog, not a dun skilly, is Mahar Fjord. Saw ban na varium, na chas cedia, na chaim gadio, saw cain speroel, eg a far gan viola, du gron chron.
Rotting in graveyard clay, beyond life's ahoy and cunning shrinks. A woman, friend of a friend, she would be jealous if she got a whiff of my goings and comings with others I know, whom at least I kissed, and of my searing love of a secret girl who will always live, but men with English will always get off with the best of things. This woman says if I hang out with her, I will get her gold, which I should prefer than the cows and herds of all Tyrone. Or a woman more beautiful than Ballyfear, but that's all that's owned. It is riches of counties, its lands and bogs, its lakes, its markets, its precious stones.